from KQED.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog. It's moving around my door.
That's the kind of music Arhuli Records in El Cerrito has been recording and curating for more than half a century. Their collection includes original recordings of Cajun, bluegrass, and gospel, blues, and other regional American music. Now, more than 350 Arhuli recordings have been acquired by the Smithsonian, ensuring that the rare recordings won't be lost. This hour, we'll talk with the founder of Arhuli Records and others, and hear lots more music. We'll get started with Forum right after this. And welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, and today for Mina Kim. In this hour, we're delving into the collection of Arhuli Records. That's the independent label based in El Cerrito that was founded in 1960. And for more than a half a century, Arhuli's founder, Chris Strachwitz, has been curating and releasing recordings of down-home regional American music. It ranges from folk, gospel, and blues to New Orleans jazz and Zydeco, including this from Clifton Chenier. And just last week, the Smithsonian announced it was acquiring more than 350 of those kinds of recordings. In this hour, we're going to celebrate the label and its contribution to American music. Let me tell you who is here with us. Right in the studio is the founder of Arhuli Records, Chris Strachwitz. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Well, thank you for having me. I mean, it's a pleasure.
Really good. And we'll talk more about that recording in a moment. But you said, as you listened, that's not a very good recording of that piece.
I don't think it's the original, no.
Okay.
I don't know where you found this one.
All right. Well, we'll come back to that in a moment. Also joining us is Maureen Gosling. She's a filmmaker with Sage Blossom Productions, and she co-produced the documentary This Ain't No Mouse Music, the story of Chris Strachwitz and Arhuli Records. Good morning to you as well.
Thank you so much.
And joining us from, I believe, Washington, D.C., Dr. Daniel Sheehy. He's director and curator of Smithsonian Folkways Recordings. Good morning to you as well.
Good morning. Great to be with you.
Yeah. So let's begin with you, Chris. How did you begin assembling? What was it that drew you to this music some 55 years ago, 56 now, I think?
Well, the radio actually was, because that was the amazing democratic medium that was available to you if you were in a city that was near Los Angeles. And I heard this amazing array of Americana music. Yeah, I heard hillbilly music over XERB in Rosarito Beach in Baja California. I heard Mexican music in the afternoon on a station in Santa Paula. And I heard Harlem Matinee with Hunter Hancock, a DJ who was beginning to play African-American popular music, you know. And the blues were just hitting. This was in the very early 50s, like 51, 52. And it was amazing of my European ears just went bananas.
And you were born in Germany?
I was born in Germany,
and you came as a young boy in 19...
Well, I came as a teenager.
Teenager.
I was 14. Let's see. I was born in 31. I came here in 47, so you figure it out.
Yeah. So a lot of people, I mean, 1960 or so, a lot of people were listening to Elvis and that genre. What did you see at that time as the connection between that transition into rock and roll and this music?
No, there was no such thing as rock and roll. They didn't call it that. I mean, it was R&B, you see, basically black music. And that's what caught me on Harlem Matinee. And I heard people like Lightning Hopkins and Howling Wolf and Sonny Boy Williamson. I mean, just absolutely extraordinary rhythmic music. I was really captivated by the rhythm more than anything else. And eventually I started to really listen to these lyrics. I mean, the blues and an amazing poetry, you know.
And how did you go about finding these artists? Because these are not people that were, you know, everyday names, right?
No, absolutely correct. No white person probably ever knew about them, and they had hardly ever met any white people. I mean, I was fascinated especially by Lightning Hopkins. And I had met Sam Charters, you know, he's the one who put out the first book about blues. The Country Blues was the name of the book. And he listened to Lightning Records in my place when I was studying here at UC Berkeley. And all of a sudden, when I was, I think it was in 59, yeah, in early 59, I got a postcard from him from Houston, Texas, saying, "Chris, I found Lightning Hopkins. He lives here in Houston." And that was just like, I had to take a pilgrimage.
So you just, literally, what, got on an airplane or got in your car and went down there?
I took a bus.
I took a bus.
Yeah, I took old Greyhound with his tongue sticking out on the side.
And just arrived in Houston? And
well, except that Lightning was supposedly being managed by a fellow named Mac McCormick. And Sam Charters had sent me that address, and so I got a hold of Mac, and I stayed at the YMCA. And
so he knew you were coming down to meet
with
him.
He knew I was coming down, and Mac was an extraordinarily knowledgeable person about the whole underbelly of Houston and Texas too. I mean, amazing. I mean, if I hadn't met him, I don't think I would have ever gotten to know Texas.
He gave you the entree.
Yeah.
How as you say, you're white, you're from Europe, you're coming into a culture that you're not so familiar with, they don't know you. How did you win their trust? How much suspicion was there about who you were?
I was simply a fan. I don't think Lightning had ever met a white fan of his. You see, when I first heard him in that beer joint on that occasion, I was absolutely amazed. It was a conversation between him and a small audience. They would yell back at him. They would talk back to him. It was just amazing. And I figured somebody ought to record this in the beer joint live. And the next year when I came with a microphone, I tried to do that. I was never successful. But
did they wonder what you were up to? Or were they just say, "Oh, this is a fan. Fantastic. It's a new audience for us."
No, well, I was then considered a record man, you see, because those he had met before, almost all the white people, I think every one of them exclusively, had been a record man, as they called them, somebody who had contacts with or had their own record company, like Bill Quinn locally in Houston, you see. He put out Lightning's first recordings, although his second ones were done by Aladdin Records, and this woman who was a contact in Houston, she took him there, you see, because Houston really didn't have hardly any studios except for Bill Quinn's Gold Star facility.
And Maureen Gosling, you've been sort of co-located in the building that Chris has been in. Is it in Berkeley or El Cerrito?
El Cerrito.
Yeah. So what have you witnessed all these years working so closely with Chris and his curation of all this music? And give us an inside view of him and the work he does and how he does it and what impact he's had.
Well, I was in the building, which is in El Cerrito, Down Home Music, Record Store. Our Arhuli Records are all in the same building. And it's a totally buzzing place. The store is fabulous. It's still running, one of the few record stores that's still open.
It's on San Pablo?
Yeah, San Pablo Avenue. Wonderful place, treasure trove. And then upstairs was Les Blank's Flower Films, which is where I was. I was there for 20 years. So that was mostly from about the late 70s to the 90s. And Les Blank, filmmaker, had a very much a symbiotic relationship with Chris, because the kinds of music that he put out were often ones that we either made films about, or sometimes we would just go down to the store, go back to our Arhuli looking for soundtracks for our films. And so we spent a lot of time hanging around with Chris, and we got to know a lot of the musicians because they would come in and say hi to him. And it was just this wonderful environment it's totally wonderful stuff happening all the time.
How many recordings, and I'll ask you both, but I'll start with you, Maureen. How many recordings would you guess? I have never been to the store. I envision things piled up all over the place. Is that just my imagination?
Well, they're better organized than that.
Yeah. Well, the store is pretty organized. And, of course, the store has every kind of other recording besides Arhuli. I mean, Arhuli is a separate business in the back, and they distribute, produce and distribute recordings. And so Chris can tell you exactly how many.
How many,
but it's
Chris?
Definitely hundreds.
I don't really know.
We talking tens of thousands?
Probably so, yeah. And, of course, every sound carrier now, you know, we carry 78s, we carry 45s, we carry 8-tracks probably, and cassettes.
So you're talking about the store.
Yeah, the store. Down Home Music Store.
Who's buying 8-tracks?
Well, yeah, you know, it's just this business is weird, but it was a fantastic business when it was going. And, you know, we all made pretty good money, and I had health plans for everybody who was worked for me in those days when I had... when the store was booming and I had a distributing company. Anyway, it was a lot of fun.
Go ahead. Finish.
And the people all who worked for me, they loved the music, you know. It wasn't like today, you have everybody has a different taste in music. There were a lot of people who liked country or who liked blues, who liked jazz, especially the older kind and so on.
Well, I want to hear some more music now. I want to play something. Mm-hmm. And before we do, this is Mance Lipscomb. Tell us a little bit about him and how you found his music.
Well, this was one of those in the year of 1960 when I went back to Texas with a tape recorder. And Mac McCormick said, listen, Chris, you have a car. Let's go out in the country because there must be people like Lightning Hopkins. You see, he wasn't that keen about Lightning, except he's trying to milk him. But anyhow,
this is in Texas?
This was in Texas, yeah. And so we drove out towards Navasota in that direction. And I'm not sure. It was probably Mac, I think, had an inkling. Lightning had made a record called Tim Moore's Farm, a very powerful protest song about like... this ain't but the one thing this black man done wrong but move his wife and family on Mr. Tom Moore's farm. If your wife runs off and leaves you, tell Mr. Moore and he'll have her brought right back. I mean, there are some lines like that. And if you keep yourself out of the graveyard, he'll keep you from the pen. Yeah. You know, some really... I had no knowledge of this whole plantation system that existed there, you see. And Tom Moore... in that town, apparently. And so Mac figured, well, if anybody knows anybody, it'll be at a feed store. So we stopped at the first feed store, and Mac, in his gruff sort of voice, said, does Tom Moore live in this town? And one guy said, yes, Mr. Moore sure does, you know. Like, you don't go around
respect.
Down
show
there.
Show some respect.
Yeah, you better show some respect. And that's how we actually met Tom Moore.
Yeah, and Mance Lipscomb is—I had heard someone mention that he was one of the very first. That was one of the very first.
Yeah,
recordings
it was the
you
first
did.
Recordings I did, and we finally met him because Tom Moore said, "You go down the railroad station." I don't know his name, but the peg leg fellow there will tell you.
Well, let's hear a little bit of this, and then we'll come back and talk.
Oh, babe, I'm tired of you. Ain't your honey, but the way you do. She goes, babe. It's all over now. All I want my baby to do, make $5 and give me two. Sugar, baby, it's all over now. Went downtown and bought me rope, put my baby till she buzzed low. Sugar, baby, it's all over now.
And again, that is Mance Lipscomb, a song called Sugar Babe. And let me ask you, Maureen Gosling, you have seen Chris interact with a lot of musicians. Describe those interactions.
Well, a lot of the people that I've seen Chris with are people that he's known for quite a long time. And so there's a lot of... you know, camaraderie and affection. I mean, that's one of the things that was really great is how Chris really maintained friendships with these people that he recorded. I mean, and he did more than just record them. Like, he helped Mance get on the blues festival even in the Bay Area, and the clubs in, like, the club in Los Angeles.
Not sure which name, but you can think about that. Let me bring in Daniel Sheehy, if I could, from the Smithsonian. Tell us what it was about this collection of music that appealed to you.
Well, okay, I've been a fan of Chris and Arhuli since the late 60s, so it's been a real pleasure. It's been a walk down memory lane for me. I think that was the Ash Grove, by the way, down in Los Angeles, if not that club. In any case, ending up in the Smithsonian Institution as director and curator of Smithsonian Folkways Recordings, and then being reconnected with Chris and Arhuli through this our whole arrangement here to keep the legacy of Chris Drakwitz and Arhuli Records going for generations to come is like a dream come true for me. So it's been a real pleasure working with Chris again closely again. And
we first met down in Veracruz, didn't we?
That's right.
When you were getting your master's or something.
I had a Fulbright. I was working with rural musicians who'd moved to Boca del Rio, which is just south of the port city of Veracruz, and doing my doctoral dissertation research. And Chris Drakwitz, I tell you, this day, Chris, I don't know how you found me, but in any case, he did. And
there's probably a lot of people who were asking that question.
Exactly.
How did he find me?
After all, some people said I should have been a detective agency instead of hunting for
musicians. That's part of the talent, though. That's part of the talent of doing what Chris has done over the years.
And so, Daniel, your label has acquired, I think, more than 350 albums. We just heard Chris say he's got tens of thousands of recordings. How did you choose?
Well, first of all, there's a little backstory to this. You know, the Smithsonian Folkways Recordings is the legacy of Moses Ash, who started Folkways Records the year after Chris arrived at the United States. So that was 1948, after Chris arrived in 1947. And he had this vision of creating an encyclopedia of humanity through recorded sound. But that vision had a purpose. There was I think of it as a social justice purpose in it. In Chris's work, I've seen a lot of a similar kind of philosophy that I've held during my professional career, and that is basically three things. Passion. Chris has lived a passion-driven life very clearly, followed his passions, recording this music and helping these musicians. The other is principles. This idea of cultural equity. There are these great artists that were invisible to the largest numbers of Americans and beyond, and Chris, you know, pulled them up. I think driven partly, Chris, you can respond to this, but out of a sense of, hey, they're supposed to be heard. These folks deserve to be heard by larger numbers of people. And the other is just plain old connoisseurship. I mean, I can't imagine someone with better taste in terms of folk artistry, folk music, than Chris Drakwitz.
Chris, let me ask you, how much of that obscurity that these musicians were living under or living in, how much of it was based on race? How much of it was based on geography, socioeconomic status, the kind of music they were playing, or was it just a combination of all those things?
Well, I was just amazed that, you know, how many cultural levels exist in this country, you know. And each region has such a distinctive sound in those days. You don't have that anymore. Ever since Nashville became Nashville, you know, country music has been homogenized and so on. But there are still pockets all over the place. You know, like in South Texas, you got this norteños, conjunto music, accordion music. Over in Louisiana, they have it with their old French language. Also kind of a weird mixture of most people who speak French can hardly understand them, but that's their problem. And of course, the fantastic blues and you know, the black world and the white world didn't meet all that much. As I said before, it was the radio that really brought us together.
But not all these musicians were black, right?
No. But they belonged to primarily minority groups, I would say, you know. And I heard all that stuff on the radio. Anyway, I was just a fan, and it was for me like an experience. Some people like to go hunt for big game in Africa, and you have to kill poor animals. No, I like to hunt for musicians who play in these regional styles, you know?
Well, let's talk a little bit. I know that you and Daniel, sounds like you did meet in Mexico, and one of the things you have really focused on, Chris, is Mexican-American music. And I want to play something from Lydia Mendoza, first of all, but maybe tell us a little bit about her.
Oh, can we play the one by Flaco first?
Sure, Flaco Jimenez. Yeah. Let's play that, and then we'll come back and talk about that.
That is much more apropos. I mean, Lydia Mendoza was a unique figure, but it was really Flaco, when Les Blank and I were filming a documentary on this border music, which absolutely I fell in love with, because it fits that area. I mean, if you ever go to South Texas or northern Mexico, you can't help but think of these accordion-playing guys, duetto singing, you know, bajo sexto, string bass, and it just got to me.
All right, well, let's hear. This is Flaco Jimenez. I think it's called Griteme Piedras del Campo.
One of the great rancheros by Cuco Sanchez.
No, well, we don't have that. Oh.
Oh, yes, you do.
Chris says, yeah, we do. Maybe we can get that in a bit, but maybe we can play something else.
All right.
Let's try. We'll try to come back to that. This is from Lydia Mendoza.
Okay.
And again, that is Lydia Mendoza, Mal Hombre, Bad Man, Chris?
Yeah, it was an amazing song when you consider it. You know, it's definitely a very powerful anti-male song. And we don't really know where it comes from, but it probably came out of the red light district in Buenos Aires, Argentina. And anyway, I wanted Lydia Mendoza to be part of the film that I was making with Les Blank on border music, but the main gist, I was very unlike Alan Lomax, who wanted the earliest forms, you know. I was not that keen on necessarily the earliest forms, but I loved what was happening in the dance halls and the cantinas right there and then. And so this fellow Flaco Jimenez, if you found his...
We did, and I'll tell you, we're going to take a short break, and okay, we're going to come back. We did find Flaco Jimenez. The piece that we're going to play will be after the break. We're talking about Arhuli Records and its recent acquisition of some of their recordings by the Smithsonian. I'm Scott Schaefer in today for Mina Kim. We've got lots more to talk about, and if you want to join us, give us a call. It's 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. Or you can email us. It's forum@kqed.org.
Dijiste que me quisiste y mientes. Cuando dices que sientes un gran amor por mí,
and that is Flaco Jimenez, Mentiste Cuando Dijiste, the name of that song. We're talking this hour with Chris Strachwitz. He's the founder of Arhuli Records, an independent label founded some 55 years ago. Also with us, Maureen Gosling, who's a filmmaker who created the documentary This Ain't No Mouse Music, the story of Chris Strachwitz and Arhuli Records. And also with us, Dr. Daniel Sheehy. He's the director and curator of Smithsonian Folkways Recordings. They just acquired about 350, more than that, recordings from Arhuli. If you want to join us, give us a call. The number, 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. Or you can email us. It's forum@kqed.org. Chris, tell us a little bit about Flaco Jimenez.
Well, he's a... He was a very young guy when I first encountered him. And, you know, an amazing accordionist. I wasn't all that wild about his singing at the time because, you know, it's not easy to find the right duetto with that can sing with you. Unlike Los Alegres de Terran, you know, where the two guys are really in sync with their voices. But anyway, when Ry Cooder joined us on that trip with Les Blank making this film, he was really taken by Flaco, although I actually preferred a guy named Fred Zimmerle, who had a group called Trio San Antonio. But anyway, Rye was really enthused about Flaco, and so we figured, well, we got to film him too.
Where did you find him?
In San Antonio. And, I mean, I'd been through there many times, and there are so many little record companies in San Antonio, it's unbelievable. And so that music was well documented, you know, and I didn't really think I should bother to be competing with those people down there since it was extraordinarily well documented. And but anyway, Flaco turned out to be one of the few people who had an ear to play with others, you see, and to pick up other types of music and to incorporate it into his own. And he eventually, you know, played with all kinds of pop artists, including, I think it was, I forgot their names, but yeah. Anyway.
Maureen, let me ask you, you did this documentary. It was called This Ain't No Mouse Music. Where does that name come from?
Well, Chris has a saying that he doesn't like mouse music. It's a jazz term, actually, mouse music, that's where you got it from, right? These guys,
yeah,
who they would play their regular gigs, which were commercial gigs, and they called it mouse music. And so he thought that was kind of cool because it kind of connected up with his idea that what he really appreciated was more authentic music. So mouse music is the opposite of authentic, down-home, deep-hearted, passionate music.
There you go.
What would you add to that, Chris?
That's good enough.
That's good enough. Dan Sheehy, when you think of the 350 or so of the recordings that are now part of the Smithsonian Folkways recordings, what are one or two that jump out at you that you're particularly proud of? Or maybe it's a whole bunch of them. Maybe it's all of them, for all I know.
Well, I have five grandchildren, and if somebody asked me which is my favorite, I would be hard pressed to do that. So I'm going to do right now what I would probably do then and say
you love them all.
There are more than two or three. You know, Chris has mentioned a few. You know, people who have become more than music. They've been touch points to American cultural musical heritage. Clifton Chenier was mm-hmm. one. The Savoy family, and with Mark, the Beausoleil, the great Cajun group, and Michael Doucet, who's with them, leads them. And jumping down into Flaco Jimenez is one of my personal absolute favorites. I'm from the San Joaquin Valley originally, so the Rose Maddox connection to Chris Strachwitz always stood out for me as well. But Chris has led a little bit of a peripatetic life, particularly in the southern half of the country. So he's run into lots of the great, what we think of now as the great American iconic folk musicians.
And Maureen, in filming your documentary, describe the interaction with Chris and these musicians, and what were some of the challenges of pulling that documentary together?
Well, Chris really wasn't that crazy about being the center of attention in the film. And so he kept trying to divert us to film the musicians. And of course, we were interested in his connection with the musicians and his interaction with the musicians. So it was sort of a combination of him being a little resistant at times and other times when he was totally, you know, we just had a ball, like in New Orleans. He was totally inspired to film the Treme Brass Band and record them. And he set up a recording session that included Michael Doucet and Uncle Lionel Batiste and great clarinetist Sammy Remington and Michael Doucet. And so we really had a ball doing that. And the same thing happened when we went to Appalachia, which was more of a search for music, because Chris hadn't spent a lot of time there.
And a lot of the music, and maybe Appalachia is one of those places where, you know, you hear the music on a front porch or in a backyard or at a picnic. You don't hear it in a club necessarily, right?
Right. So we filmed Santiago Jimenez Jr., Flaco Jimenez's brother, playing on his front porch. And it was beautiful, just beautiful. And that was the case. I mean, and we filmed the No Speed Limit playing in their driveway. And the one microphone, which is how Chris recorded many of his musicians, we did that for the film. And it was, you know, the musicians, the kind of music, the style of music was very appropriate with the one mic situation, because the musicians already had this nice balance among the instruments.
So, Chris, describe the process of recording. You're there, you've got one mic. Is it just on a mic stand, or are you holding it and moving it from you know, musician to musician? I mean, how did that work?
That depends. No, usually I put it on a stand
your arm would get awfully tired otherwise.
And, yes, and of course, it's easy to record one guy with a guitar, you know, or something, as long as you place the microphones so that it balances between the voice and the guitar. Like Mance Lipscomb has a very low voice for singing, but I figured that out. While somebody like Big Joe Williams, he sang very strong. And so, you know, you just had to use your ear trying to figure it out, unless you happen to go to a studio. I think what she was telling us is that they want to play this one by...
yes, Rose. We have some music from
Rose Maddox. Yeah.
We do.
Well, I heard when I first came to this country, yeah, we were living near Monterey, and they were broadcasting on KTRB in Modesto, California. They were called the Maddox Brothers and Rose, America's most colorful hillbilly band. And they were something else. I mean, they had a ball playing music, you know. And,
let's hear some of it now.
This is one of the more interesting songs.
This is called Single Girl.
Single Girl.
I used to be afraid no one would ever wed me, and I'd die sour old maid. Now I am married and I set me down to weep, 'cause my husband chaws tobacco and he snores in his sleep. Oh Lord, I wish I was a single girl again. Lord, I wish I was a single girl again. Now we are married, and what do you think? He bought a gingham apron and he showed me to the sink.
Oh, Chris, how unusual was it for women to be sort of the front singer in these bands?
Yeah, well, that's exactly how they started that group. It was Fred Maddox, he was the bass player, and they were working as field hands here, you know, fruit pickers, fruit tramps, they called themselves. They came as part of the Great Migration during the 30s to California, you know. And he got tired of picking cotton and working the fruit yards. And the family always sang together. You see, the mother, Maddox lady, she really ruled that family. And he said one day, I got tired of working out there. I want to go to the radio station and see if we can't get a radio program. And so he went to KTRB, and they said, well, if you've got a girl singer, we'll let you go on the air.
And how about your sister?
Said, yes, we do. I think she was 9 years old or something. I forgot. It was.
Wow.
That was the requirement. And so
why? Rose, why was that a requirement?
Rose suddenly had to become the front singer in the band, you know?
Yeah. Why did they want a female singer?
I don't know. I guess they thought that was the
That's what people wanted
thing.
To hear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so Rose Maddox filled the bill, and she became pretty independent later on, you know, when the band broke up and she went on her own. That was, of course, much later in the 60s when I recorded her, or 70s, actually.
Well, what do you say we bring some of our listeners in? We've got some folks who'd like to talk with you. And again, that number is 866-733-6786. And we'll start in Oakland. Milton, welcome.
Yeah, hi. This is great. I've been loving our Hooli and Folkways records for decades. I browse through record bins, and once in a while, my jaw would drop, because one day, and I think this is true, Chris, you could confer this, there was a record full of Czech music, of Czechoslovakians who settled in
Correct.
Texas. Who would have known that? My goodness, it's delightful.
Yeah, so, it was actually one of the Lomax brothers that told me, you know, Chris, when you're driving back to California from Texas, you should stop in Shiner, I think. Oh, I forgot, it was one of those little towns there in the center. And there's a large population of, they call them Czechs, but they were actually, most of them from the province of Moravia in what used to be Czechoslovakia. And they settled in Texas in the 1850s, I believe, or 1880s, sometimes. It was very fertile land. Of course, there were still Indians in those days giving them trouble. But anyhow, no, that was a delightful thing to find. And they even made early recordings in the late 20s of this Texas Czech music.
And Milton, are you a regular at the record store?
Well, I have to admit guiltily that it's been a while since I've been there, but every time I went there, it was delightful. It was like having a birthday every day over there. And the guys who work there, they really know their stuff. It's a delightful world, in other words.
Yeah. Thank you.
Is. So be yeah. well. Thank you very much.
All right, Milton. Thanks so much for calling. And let me ask Daniel Sheehy, besides acquiring these recordings, what does the Smithsonian do not just to keep them alive and preserve them, but to spread the word about them and educate folks about this music?
Well, we do everything we can. In fact, that's part of the mandate that we also acquired for Moses Ash and his legacy, and that was to keep everything available. And these days, that means keep everything available in every possible format that there is out there. So you know, the streaming services, Pandora, Spotify, download services, iTunes. We have physical product available for every single recording that's in the 12 record labels in the collection. And so, and we have a small but a passionate marketing department that loves the stuff. These are all passion-driven people, and we want to push it out into the world for the foreseeable future. That's half of our goal, is to preserve this, the Our Hooli collection and the story of Chris Strachwitz and Our Hooli for future generations, and the other half is to push it out right now at every opportunity we get.
You know, this is a little bit out of left field, and I'll open this to anybody, but Chris, feel free to jump in. You know, we live in a time that is so politically polarized, you know, a lot of the places you've mentioned, Texas and Appalachia, you know, Louisiana, tend to be more conservative places. I'm just wondering, do you see a political message at all in the music or in trying to promote the music and share the music to a wider audience?
I don't really want to comment on that. I think this music was popular in its own area, whatever it was, Cajun, Creole, Tex-Mex, whatever you want to call it, whatever the area is. And in Appalachia, you know, it was simply known as mountain music or hillbilly music, and now it is known as bluegrass. It's just that they were anxious, like Flacco said, you know, he really appreciated that it took somebody like me to take him out into the world, you know, because they could sell hundreds of records locally, and that's what they lived on. Those were their bread and butter, records were in those days, you know.
Yeah, Maureen?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I think that the music and the the recordings that came out and a lot of what Chris did really helped during like the civil rights period. I mean, it was never talked about. It wasn't the conscious thing, but black musicians were being heard and appreciated by white people, and people started hanging out together at clubs, and I think it really helped. And it was on this other level that was beyond all the
political divisions.
Exactly.
Cultural and, I think and it totally, socioeconomic. Yeah.
Music does that. And I just think it's an incredible, music and the arts just play this role that is not given enough credit.
Daniel Sheehy, anything to add to that?
Yeah, sure. Just echoing a little bit what Maureen was saying there. But for me, it's two words. It's bridging and bonding. And a lot of what I think you're referring to there, Scott, had to do, I think, with lack of understanding, lack of communication, lack of, feeling like we're in this together. And what better way to discover other people, other tastes, other values than through music, particularly the music you find in the Arhuli and Folkways collections. And I say bonding because if we can all understand each other better, then that next level up gold mine is bonding, is feeling together. We are one nation, we are one people, and a pluribus unum really is true, and we're living that life. So anyway, that's how I'd sum it up.
Yeah. Here we got some comments from social media. Heidi writes, I love that Forum has chosen to honor this treasured Bay Area label. Wanted to send out a plug for our Arhuli artist Howell Devine and their release, Modern Sounds of Ancient Juju. Definitely worth checking out if you haven't had the pleasure of hearing them or seeing them live. What can you tell us about them, Chris?
Well, that was one of the few. I never used to think that white kids can play the blues, but I should have been more open to that. And these guys are really fantastic. It is delightful. They don't overdo it. So many white players try to imitate blacks totally, while these guys don't. He has a wonderful voice on his own. I said their record, it was great. They have actually two on Arhuli now, Howell Devine. And they do them very traditionally. I mean, I think this is the other thing about Texas and Louisiana. They are conservative, that's true, but that also helps preserve traditions. You see, like the Cajuns have never given up their dance music. They still play it to some degree. It's not as popular as it used to be, but it's more popular outside of the area. And that goes with anybody, as people go into the different category of earning and so forth. Anyway, I don't want to go into that.
Before we get to another phone call, let's play some more music. And this is Fred McDowell, a song called You Gotta Move is the name of this one.
Oh, that's a good one.
You got to move, you got to move, you got to move, child, you got to move. But when they're long, get ready, you got to move.
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead, Chris.
Well, this is a particular tune that actually Fred McDowell made quite a good bit of money on. It's the biggest check he ever got in his life was because of the Rolling Stones recorded his sort of arrangement or version of it. And I published things. I became aware of the fact through Ed Denson that I needed to protect these musicians that I was recording if they had original material, you see. And it always happened to numbers where there was some problem. But anyhow, we eventually persuaded the manager of the Rolling Stones
Well, it raises another question about how did these artists share in the royalties, or in how were they compensated?
Well, that's through my publishing company called Tradition Music Company, which copywrote all original material in their respective names.
All right. And we're talking for the rest of this hour with Chris Strachwitz and Daniel Sheehy and Maureen Gosling about our Hooli Records. And maybe we've got some more music to play as well. But first, we're in a fundraising period here at KQED. For more information on how to support KQED, you can go to kqed.org. I'm Scott Schaefer. And let's go to the phones. Some folks have been waiting patiently to join us. Robin in Vallejo, welcome.
Hi, good morning. I just wondered if anyone was familiar at all with a gentleman who came up during the time that Dylan and Joan Baez did in the Boston area by the name of Buzz Martin with an E. Yeah.
Buzz Martin, that sound familiar?
I remember the name, yes. He came from back east, I think.
What do you want to tell us about him, Robin?
Well, I found out about his musical past when I was house-sitting for him and his wife and pulled out a coffee table book, was flipping through the pages, and found Buzz amongst the photos of Joan Baez and the others during that folk era. I just wondered if anybody knew anything more about that, because he never really spoke of it. He became owner of a pewter foundry, and later, after he had a bone marrow transplant, he spent 3 years flying gliders in Calistoga. But he did pass away, I believe, in 92.
Yeah. Chris?
It was a time during the era when, unlike an earlier era when only Dyer Bennett and Burl Ives and so on were considered folk singers, all of a sudden here came a whole new crop of so-called folk singers, while at the same time there was an interest in presenting the authentic rural people at folk festivals. That became the big thing. And thank goodness for my part of the program, this was a chance for people like Mance Lipscomb and Fred McDowell and all those people from down home, down south. They were given the chance to be heard at folk festivals, you know.
All right. Well, thanks for the call, Robin. Appreciate that. Let's go to Concord next, and David is on the line. Welcome.
Hi, how are you? Thank you. Chris, I have a real question for you. I mean, you and I are kind of kindred spirits. I've been a serious amateur musicologist, recording wherever I go and traveling the world. And, you know, in this world of changing musical technology, from your vantage point of history, what advice would you give someone who's like yourself but your grandkids' age? What advice would you give me or people like me to do next? I mean, things are so different than it was when you were doing it. What would you suggest we do?
Chris?
Do what drives you. You know,
if you
have a passion for something, that's what you got to do. I don't care if it's unknown, some sounds, you know, throat singing or boogaloo music or whatever. If you really love it, then dig it.
All right, David, there you go. That's good advice in general, I'd say. Chris, I'm wondering, you know, over all the years, was there anyone who you wished you could have recorded and for whatever reason you just weren't able to?
Oh, yeah, well... There was a bunch of opportunities I blew. One especially was Sonny Boy Williamson, who finally, the last time I met him was in Helena, Arkansas. And, you know, he did these daily radio broadcasts, and I was so concerned about bootlegging his early trumpet recordings that I should have just grabbed my machine and recorded a new session because there was all kinds of wonderful musicians there. I blew it.
One of the ones that got away.
Yeah.
All right, let's see if we can sneak another call or two in here. Christina in Oakland, welcome.
Hello. Hi, Chris. Hi, Maureen. I really enjoyed watching the film.
Great, thank you.
I'm in my 20s and really enjoy singing, and people usually ask where my musical passions come from, and I say, I don't know, I just primarily listen to records by dead people. So I really appreciate Smithsonian Collection. And all the old-timey music that you've hunted down and recorded, Chris. And I'm wondering if you might have any go-tos for live music around the Bay Area, or maybe a summer concert or festival that you're looking forward to going to.
Huh. Well, there's always some good music around, and you can always find out something at the Freight and Salvage, I guess. But, you know, I've been sort of out of commission. I had a kind of a health problem for a while where I fantasized things and so forth, but I'm back to normal almost. And I think you just have to keep your ears open and or listen to people. You know, there's so much stuff happening in every category almost in the Bay Area.
Yeah. What would you add, Maureen?
Well, there's a Cajun music in Alameda, actually. On Friday nights, they have, there's a place you go dancing. And it's...
what's it called?
The
Eagle Hall.
Eagle's Hall. And they even bring in musicians directly from Louisiana. And it's a real scene. It's kind of amazing. And then, of course, there's the Ashkenaz, which has lots of great stuff.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, we are at the end of our hour, and we're going to go out with a little bit more music, but I want to thank all of our guests. This hour, Chris Strachwitz, founder of Arhuli Records, Dr. Daniel Sheehy, director and curator of Smithsonian Folkways Recordings, and Maureen Gosling, filmmaker who was the co-producer of This Ain't No Mouse Music, the story of Chris Strachwitz and Arhuli Records. We're going out with Trio San Antonio. Anything
you
want to say about it?
Fred Zimmerle is the accordionist, and he was my favorite.
All right, let's hear a little bit of that. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, Susan Britton, and Penny Nelson. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from Amanda Font. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our executive producer is Joanne Wallace. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks so much for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.